Everyone, and welcome to our 112th race and policing discussion. My name is Amber Broaden. I serve as an adjunct faculty in the psychology department at both CSU Dominguez Hills as well as San Bernardino with a specialization in forensic psychology. Today we will be talking about a recently published children's book called Something Happened in Our Town, which I'm very excited for you all to hear about from the authors today. Before we get into our conversation, I would like to pass it along to my colleague, Mary, for our land acknowledgement.
Greetings, everyone. I'm Mary Texera, and I used to teach sociology in another life, but this is my second career devoted to policing and police law and criminal justice reform. But today I would like to acknowledge the land on which we sit at Cal State San Bernardino. We recognize that this university sits on the territory and ancestral land of the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. We recognize that every member of the California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this and what I would call sacred land since the institution's founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. By offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm Indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold California State University San Bernardino more accountable to the needs of American Indian and Indigenous peoples. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleague, Michael German.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mike German. I'm a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice and a former FBI agent. And I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Robbie.
Thank you, Mike. My name is Robbie Madrigal. I'm from the Fowl Library. I've been with the series since its founding in 2020, and we're really excited about our special guest today. I'll now turn it over to the Dean of CSU Libraries, Rebecca Lubis.
Greetings, everyone. I am really delighted that we're featuring this important book today. It's unusual for us to be talking about a children's book, but this is such a special book in how it serves the purpose of being able to teach, to have a conversation about race and policing with children. The book, copy here, and yes, we do have a copy in the Fowl Library for you to check out, Something Happened in Our Town, is part of a really useful series by the American Psychological Association. They have an imprint called Imagination Press, and all of the books deal with tough topics to talk to children about. And they often have in the back of the book a note to parents and caregivers that give typical questions a child might ask and how to engage with these really tough topics. In this particular book here, the authors, who are all psychologists themselves, Dr. Solano, Dr. Hazard, and Dr. Collins, I believe you all met while you were working over a long period of time at Emory University, collaborated on this story and collaborated with an illustrator to really kind of sensitively portray children in a town dealing with a police shooting of an African-American person and all the feelings that come up with that. And I really appreciate how the book goes from the point of view with a Black family and with a white family and the kinds of questions those children would have, because children see things. They ask tough questions, and children asking tough questions has lately been the subject at the heart of the book banning and book challenge controversy. Many of you who have followed some of the things we've been doing in the library this past year know that we've engaged with why books are challenged. And in this particular case, the topic of the series that brings us together today, race and policing, this is one of the topics that has popped up in Book Challenge. This particular book that we're talking about today is the sixth most challenged book according to the ALA in the year of 2020, not surprisingly linked with the year of the George Floyd murder. And one of the main reasons for the challenge is a possible negative portrayal of police. And if you've read the book, you know that this is a very sensitive conversation about, you know, some police do things that, you know, are not good things. And it's written, you know, again, at a level that a young reader can understand that. So many of the other books that we've talked about have been about the topic of race and policing too. You know, early last year, you know, one of the books that we discussed the most was Hate U Give, which has to do with a police shooting as well. So this is a very timely topic for race and policing, and also very much talks about the concept of what we can engage children in and how children can navigate these issues of our time, and, you know, how we deal with that some folks are uncomfortable that we're talking to young people about these topics. So I really appreciate our authors on a personal level. I was familiar with the series even before this came up because on a personal note, my husband is a psychologist and he uses the Imagination Press books in his practice. So I'm very, very happy to give this series some spotlight. So thank you so much to our authors, and I will turn it over to them.
All right, thank you. I'm going to share my screen and hope that everyone can see it. Thank you for those kind words and for being such an advocate of Imagination Press books. On behalf of the three of us, we're delighted to be presenting to such a multidisciplinary audience. We appreciate our conversations with you in planning today's event. So we're going to talk about promoting anti-racism through children's picture books, if I can figure out how to make it move. And it's not working. Let me try something else. There we go. Okay, so Something Happened in Our Town was written actually in 2016, 2017, and published in 2018. It didn't become very popular until the summer of 2020 after the murder of George Floyd. But it is the first of the Something Happened series. We have written other books. The second book in the series is Something Happened in Our Park, which is about community gun violence, and Anne will be talking about that a little bit later. And then we had Something Happened to My Dad, also published in Spanish, Algo Le Pasó a Mi Papá, and that's about immigration and family separation. And then the most recent book in the series is Something Happened to Our Planet, and that one's about climate change, and Marietta and I wrote that last year. We won't really be discussing that one today, though. A little background on us. Yes, the three of us are psychologists. We met at Grady Hospital, a large urban hospital in Atlanta, serving a primarily low-income African-American population. We were all working there, I think, for, I don't know, 20, 30 years. I'm still with Emory, which I was working for Emory at Grady. I'm still with Emory. Marietta retired from Emory and is now at Morehouse School of Medicine. And Anne retired, and is now writing children's books and doing other things. Like other children's books, and as is common in the book industry, we did not pick the illustrator for the book. The illustrator is picked by Imagination Press, the publisher, but we were delighted with Jennifer Zivoyne's illustrations for Something Happened in Our Town. All the books have different illustrators. There's some pictures of us promoting the book. Okay, so why did we write this book? This book grew out of our concern about the well-publicized disproportionate police killings of unarmed African-American men, women, and children, including the murder of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, which, as you recall, was a long time ago, 2014, in Cleveland. We wondered how kids and families made sense of these events and how the news reports affected them. What kinds of conversations were they having about it? What kinds of conclusions would kids draw about Black people and the absence of informed conversations about why these police killings were happening? As psychologists, we knew these questions might be answered differently for Black families than for white families. After all, research shows that many Black families already try to prepare their kids for encounters with police officers who may treat them as older or more dangerous than they really are, sometimes with harmful results. This talk is considered part of healthy racial ethnic socialization for Black youth in the United States. In contrast, most white families don't ever talk about racism, much less race. Psychologists have developed theories and conducted research about racial identity, primarily for youth of color. This body of work rests on a fundamental question: what does it mean to have a healthy racial identity in a racist society? We wanted our book to be relevant to all children and to focus on the perspectives of white children as well as Black children. Like others, we wondered how parents can help promote a healthy racial identity for white children without supporting white privilege. Okay, so as an author, finding your way into a story is a bit like learning how to ride a bike as a kid. It's hard at first, but after a while it gets easier. In the book industry, this entryway is sometimes called voice or the personality of a story. It's a mixture of vocabulary, point of view, syntax, and tone that helps the writing kind of flow and hang together. For us, the voice started with these sentences on the first page. And I have to open my book because on Zoom, the words are covered by everyone's faces. Something bad happened in our town. The news was on the TV, the radio, and the internet. The grown-ups didn't think the kids knew about it, but the kids in Miss Garcia's class heard some older kids talking about it, and they had questions. The story follows two children, Emma, who is white, and Josh, who is Black. Both kids talk with their parents about an incident in which a police officer shot an unarmed Black man. We had three messages we wanted to convey. The first message was about systemic racism. But how do you present this abstract concept to children who don't understand yet how society works? Systemic racism permeates our social and institutional structures, operates at multiple levels, and is often perpetuated without awareness or intention to harm. Children can understand the concept of fairness, like in an interpersonal context, so-and-so wasn't fair, but that concept doesn't really get at the systemic nature of systemic racism. So to talk about systemic racism, we would need a different vocabulary. We decided to use the term pattern. The word racism is never used in the story. And I'm gonna pass this on to Marietta.
Okay, great, great. Hello, everyone. If you look at this particular page, this is probably the spread that got us in the most trouble. And this is when we see the Black family talking together about the police shooting. And again, the story, based upon the story, the youngest child overhears about a police shooting and he comes home and talks with his parents about it. Here, we see the older brother saying, cops stick up for each other and they don't like Black men. And the younger one, of course, is very confused because he's like, why not? You know, some cops are Black. And his mom is like, yes, you know, that is the case because they have a friend who's Black. But his dad says there are many cops, Black and white, who make good choices, but we can't always count on them to do what's right. And that's the first time where we talk about police in a way that really I guess I'll say cause some consternation. Okay. And here in this particular one, we wrote these sentences to really capture the concerns and experiences of Black men, of Black people, I'm sorry, with as relates to cops. You know, there are many cops, Black and white, as the dad says, who make good choices, but we can't always count on them to do what's right. Okay. But going on to the next page here, we see that the we're going to try and continue, you know, to talk about diversity. We're going to talk about the value of diversity. And we try to communicate that, you know, from the perspective of our white character, Emma, as she talks with her older teenage sister, okay? And she talks about the fact that, you know, there is value in diversity. Suppose there was a birthday party and everybody was invited except the little Black girl. How would she feel, okay? She would feel pretty badly, okay? But aside from that, you don't know what you'd be missing out on because you've never given yourself a chance to get to know this child, and you'll never know who is going to be your best friend. So again, we wanted to introduce the concept that there is value in diversity, value in learning about differences from other people and not judging them solely on the basis of what they look like. Okay. And here, as we go on, the third message of our book was that kids can recognize and confront acts of racial discrimination. And here we see a new student who's coming to join the classroom. He's from a foreign country, doesn't speak English very well, you know, looks very scared. And what basically happens is that the kids go outside at recess to play soccer. And because he does not appear to speak English well, doesn't really know anybody, excuse me, some of the other kids decide they don't want him on their team. They're discriminating against him based upon how he looks and what he says. And based upon the experiences of Emma and Josh and the conversations that they had had with their parents, they decide to stand up for this, for their friend. And they say here, and just like that, Emma and Josh gained a new friend and started a better pattern in their school. And as Mariana said earlier, we talked about and really kind of struggled with how to really talk about patterns and racism in our book on a level that kids could understand. But here, as we see, they have a new pattern of a friend who does not look like either of them. And it's a pattern that in the past has been exemplified by residential and social segregation. But here we see these young people creating a new pattern with a new friend in their school. Okay. And as was alluded to earlier, one of the things that we're very grateful for in terms of Imagination Press is the fact that at the back of not only this book, but all of our books, excuse me, is an extensive note to parents and caregivers, or a reader's note. And in this particular section of our book, we really provide a rationale and tips for really how to talk about racial injustice with young children. We talk about issues that are unique for African-American families, and we also provide child-friendly vocabulary and definitions, and even one of the sample parent-child dialogues, you know, that we've used, you know, comes from the perspective of, you know, I don't want to play with Keisha because, you know, she looks dirty. She's Black. She looks dirty. If your child were to say that to you, what would your response be? How would you be able to answer that question? And even, you know, from the perspective of Black kids, well, you know, let's say Jada she's darker skinned than I am. You know, I don't want to play with her. So again, we try and tackle different topics, you know, that parents might often be faced with in a way that is hopefully very helpful, you know, to them in terms of engaging in conversations with their children. The other piece of our note to our readers and parents and caregivers is there are free online resources that are updated annually. And these resources are for educators, you know, librarians, as well as parents. And we're just really grateful and happy that we're able to continue to provide up-to-date information on these topics.
And those resources are online. Okay, and?
So I want to introduce the audience to two additional books in the Something Happened series that can also foster discussions of systemic racism. Something Happened in Our Park is about Miles and his family. You can see Miles on the cover. He's the kid with the blue shirt. At the beginning of the book, he learns that his teenage cousin Keisha has been injured in a shooting at a neighborhood park. And she's understandably anxious, or he's understandably anxious about neighborhood safety. We wrote this book because the prevalence of guns in the United States makes firearm injuries a risk for all of us. You might be surprised to learn, or you might not, that 15,000 children and teens are killed or injured annually in the United States. Probably millions witness gun violence. So it's a prevalent problem. We also made a choice to set the book in a primarily Black neighborhood because Black children are at particular risk. A recent study showed that Black boys are 10 times more likely to be hospitalized for a firearm injury than white boys. So we wanted to draw attention to this as a community problem and give voice to the concerns of Black families. At the same time, we were very conscious of wanting to counter the racist myth that Black people are inherently more inclined to violence. So there are no Black criminals in the story. Instead, Miles is part of a loving two-parent family that's educationally oriented. Keisha's staying with the family to go to college. The increased violence in the neighborhood is attributed to economic disinvestment. So you can see on the left side of the, this page is kind of in the middle of the story. After Miles has expressed a wish that he's scared in the neighborhood, he wishes they could move. And his father says, there's less money and more violence here since the factory closed, but we can't afford to move. The other point we wanted to make in the book to sort of counter myths is to discuss community strengths. So we see mom saying, this is where your dad and I grew up. There's a lot that we love about this place, like Grandma B's red velvet cake and the 8th Avenue Church Choir. Oops, I got to get my book too. And then his dad goes on to say, the most important thing is that the people here care for each other. As the story progresses, the community works together to increase opportunities in the community and to increase safety. At a gathering at the end of the story, the mayor proclaims that the mayor has allocated funds for a new factory. So there's some economic investment. And in her speech, she says, violence ends when dreams begin, which we really believe is true. So the book presents some systemic solutions or directions for the problems of community violence, but also deals with Miles as an individual little boy and how he copes with his anxiety and overcomes it to start living his life again more fully. Next slide. A third book I wanted to highlight is Something Happened to My Dad, also available in Spanish. I wrote this with a fourth author who's not here today, but she also was part of our little gang at Grady Hill Systems, child psychiatrist Viviana Ponte Rivera, who grew up in Puerto Rico. So her first language was Spanish, which enabled her to easily translate, to do the Spanish translation. So in this story, the main character is Carmen, who we see on the left side with a red bow in her hair. She is very distraught when her undocumented Mexican-American father is detained and is at risk of deportation. And at first, her mother tells her not to tell anyone what's going on because she's aware of the negative stereotypes about immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, and especially immigrants of color. So on this page, we see Carmen blurting out the situation to her friend and experiencing a variety of reactions. So in the library, Rosa asked her what was wrong. Carmen covered her mouth, but words rushed out anyway. Poppy got arrested because he doesn't have papers. He might get deported back to Mexico. What if I never see him again? Some kids had been listening, and they told some other kids. A few gave Carmen funny looks. But Nazar said, "My favorite neighbor doesn't have papers." So you can see that one issue that the book is dealing with is that stigma towards immigrants can lead to isolation, family separation, and problematic policies. This story, as it evolves, also seeks to counter negative stereotypes. We get to know Carmen's father through her memories. He's a hardworking man. He's fun and a loving father. The community, this also has a community empowerment theme, similar to something happened in our park. So the community rallies to support Carmen's family in hiring an attorney. And Carmen uses a variety of strategies to cope with being separated from her father. So, you know, a second message that is embedded in the book is that newcomer families have strengths and they also have a lot of commonalities with citizen families. The book, figuring out how to end the book was an interesting challenge for this one because we wanted to be realistic, but also encourage hope. So what we came up with, I don't know how well you can see this, is the last page of the book is a children's drawing. You can see it's, you know, doesn't look like the other illustrations. So it's a children's drawing, presumably by Carmen, that has her dad, Carmen, and the mom together. So it is left up to children to decide whether this is what really happened or whether this represents what Carmen hopes will happen. So that was the way we ended this particular story. Next slide. So a really fun and also very enlightening part of writing children's books is what happens afterwards, which is that you get to interact with a lot of children in classrooms. You get to have workshops with adults. We've met with groups of parents, teachers, librarians, faith leaders, business employees. Yeah, I forgot about what were the two big businesses? Was it Walmart?
Walmart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it J. Morgan Chase, Mary? Yeah. There was a
anyway, so we've had very diverse groups of adults we've talked to. And most of what we've talked about has been race conscious parenting with adult audiences. And why have we chosen to deal with that topic? First of all, as y'all well know, there are very contradictory messages about race in the United States. We celebrate, you know, our ideal of freedom and justice for all, but that's not the current reality. It's certainly not the historical reality. That's not the current reality. And the contradiction between our ideals and reality is pretty confusing, especially for children. Secondly, although some parents, you know, aren't quite aware of this or sort of shut their eyes to this, children very readily notice race and they notice disparities. And in the absence of discussion about what has contributed to those disparities, kids are going to make up their own explanations for why disparities exist. And those explanations are likely to reflect bias and myths embedded in our culture. So if you think about a message that all kids get. You know, work hard and you're going to succeed in school and succeed in life. Well, what happens when a kid who's, let's say, what happens when a white kid whose parents aren't talking about race, you know, drives through a Black neighborhood that is poorer and notices that? You know, they're likely to draw some conclusions about why that happened. They might draw the conclusion that maybe Black people didn't work as hard, or that maybe they're not as smart. And those are the sort of race-based myths that, you know, have been deliberately, you know, offered to support racism in our country. So without talking about it and countering those myths, kids are going to grow up with bias. Adult silence also conveys that it's, you know, there's something bad or scary about talking about race. And we know that white parents in particular, many feel uncomfortable talking about race and are less likely to do that. So next slide, our talks about race conscious parenting. First of all, try to convey the benefits of this. First of all, what it is. And so race-conscious parenting is parenting that actively celebrates diversity. So, you know, exposing kids to diverse people, places, books, depending on, you know, how much segregation there is in your community, you may have to do this very intentionally to make it happen. And also not being scared to label or talk about race. I mean, most preschoolers are going to, when they see someone of a different race, they're going to have curiosity, just like they ask about a different hairdo or a, you know, bright colored outfit. They're going to say, you know, why does that man have brown skin? If that's, you know, something they haven't seen before or haven't seen often. So instead of shushing them, we encourage parents to give a matter-of-fact explanation. He was born with brown skin, just like I was born with tan skin. People come in all different skin colors. That's kind of cool, isn't it? So you haven't shut down the conversation. You've opened it up. A second important aspect of these conversations or approach to parenting is to acknowledge disparities and acknowledge white privilege, both historically and current day. I think a lot of kids end up with the impression that the civil rights movement solved racism, and that's far from the case. So acknowledging the existence of racism is very important, and promoting anti-racism, making clear the benefits of inclusion and diversity, and modeling for your child and talking about ways that you can be part of making a change to make things more fair. Next slide. I think we maybe skipped one. Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm wrong. I see the resources on the side. I was thinking this was two separate slides. So, in terms of resources to help parents do this, one really great resource that we've collaborated with a bit is Embrace Race. This is a national organization that has a really rich website that includes a lot of written resources. They did sort of 2 to 3 years of great webinars talking to parents about very specific topics, and educators as well, about, you know, how to raise kids. Their motto is, you know, we want to raise kids who are thoughtful, informed, and brave about race. Currently, they are working on a more extensive curriculum to help parents feel prepared to do this. And they have sort of four pillars. You can see the purple pillar is raising resilient and joyful children. This is particularly relevant for children of color, trying to find, you know, to know how to foster pride and self-love for kids, to integrate resilience and joy as they learn about race. So to not only learn about so the bad aspects of racism, but to learn some of the strengths of those who have fought against racism. A second pillar is to raise inclusive and empathic children, particularly important for white families. So to be open about differences and to celebrate differences, to expose kids to diversity, build empathy. Then the last two pillars have to do with promoting anti-racism. It's not enough to celebrate diversity. You also have to actively address racism. So to help kids be critical thinkers about race, who recognize that bias and discrimination exist, and can be better prepared to understand that if it happens to them, and then to model and encourage advocacy. We certainly celebrate, this is not our concept, but we believe that if you're not actively challenging racism, you are supporting the racist status quo. Those are some of the concepts that Embrace Race helps parents with. And then we've listed on the right a couple of other great resources for educators. And these are particularly for educators of elementary through high school. Obviously, many people on the call are educators of young adults. The resources we've listed here are great for younger kids. Next slide. So our last slide before we are open for discussion lists our contact information. All of us are glad to hear from you if you have a question. And this slide also illustrates the importance of self-care and looking for, you know, for those moments that can rejuvenate you, because this is difficult work and these are tough topics. I mean, those moments may just be a beautiful question or a beautiful comment from a student, but here's a slightly bigger event that we got to be a part of that helped us all feel good about our involvement. So I'll let Marietta share what this slide is showing.
Oh, for sure. This is a slide of a discussion that happened as a result of a play that the Children's Theater Company in Milwaukee, is that correct? Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
No, Minneapolis.
Minneapolis. I always get them confused. I'm sorry. Minneapolis, Minnesota. Okay. Minneapolis, Minnesota developed based upon something happened. It happened in our town. It was really, it's been a highlight of our career for them to take the, you know, the words from this book and to actually, you know, see it come to life, you know, with people acting out the characters. It was very exciting for us. We got a chance to tour behind the scenes. We got a chance, of course, to meet the directors and the developer and to see how they were actually able to transpose, you know, our book into a play. And again, because this is unfortunately where the murder of George Floyd took place, it was really poignant and relevant to the community. Lots of schools were invited to come and look at the play. You know, after each performance, there was discussion. And again, it was certainly something that we'll never forget. So we're really pleased that that happened.
Okay, I think that's done. I'm gonna stop sharing and see if anyone has questions.
So I'm going to read in the Q&A first a comment. There's a comment more than a question. I thought you'd appreciate hearing it. This book would be a great resource in schools because we need to work together, both families and school, to educate new generations and also adults. Thank you for this great work. So I thought you'd appreciate the appreciation. And I would add to that, that I have found as part of working with some of these banned books, which are often frequently books for younger readers, that sometimes the either a children's book or a young adult book can be a great springboard for adults to talk about tough topics too, instead of reading a scholarly work or a more dense work. Sometimes, you know, reading something that might be aimed at a younger reader kind of helps us as adults process these really tough topics too. Because maybe we didn't deal with some of these topics when we were that age, and that level is a more accessible one.
Right. In fact, we encourage adult readers, parents, and teachers to read the note at the back of the book before they decide to share this book with their students or with their own children. And one of the more controversial moments that we encountered with this title was when, I think it was during the pandemic, when someone, not us, but someone else made a YouTube video of the book. And remember, schools were happening, lessons were happening virtually. And so I think a teacher just put on a YouTube in which there was, I guess, an animation along with the words of our story, but the teacher had not read the book or had seen the material at the back of the book. And some, I think it was a fifth grade classroom. Am I right, Anna Marietta? Was it fourth or fifth? It was.
Yeah, it was an older elementary class.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And a kid went home and told their parent about it. And the parent, I can't remember if the parent was a police officer or knew someone that was a police officer.
The
but
parent, right, the parent.
Yeah, but registered disapproval and objected to the book. And that led to a lot of, you know, discussion about whether the book should be read in elementary schools. And to many schools' attempts, and some successful to ban the book. And the most recent banning that I know about was a high school. Mm-hmm. That was last year, a high school banned our book.
Right. And, you know, one thing we've always been very clear about with not only this book, but all of our books, is that these books are not the kind of books you would just give to your children to go off into a corner and read by themselves. Mm-hmm. We really want this to be a collaborative effort between, you know, parent and child, or between teacher and child. And again, as Marianne said, you know, to look at the back of the book, look at the content of it before you make a decision as to whether or not this is an appropriate book to read. We think it's appropriate. Well, you know, for everybody, we can't really think of anybody who might, this might not be appropriate, you know, for, of course, there are younger kids who might not understand it, you know, but certainly it's a collaborative effort to try to understand and stimulate conversation, ongoing conversation and dialogue about social justice.
Why do you think people in power are so threatened by this and other similar books? That should be an easy one. That should be a slam dunk.
I was going to say, because it certainly does disturb the norm. It disturbs the norm of what has been the accepted practice in our country, you know, for years, and continues to be an accepted practice in our country. And to hear voices that are challenging this can be very threatening, you know, to people, is what I'll say. And I'll just toss it to Anne or Marianne to continue with it.
Well, I, you know, obviously police are used to being in power and used to that power not being challenged. While we feel like the book, I mean, it was a struggle, and we had to debate various wordings, but we wanted to hold true to the reality that there is disproportionate use of force by police against communities of color. We didn't want to demonize police. Mm-hmm. And, I think we did a pretty successful job of it, but But it is, I will say, you know, the challenges have come from white communities, and particularly communities where, you know, often a family of a police officer that, you know, that doesn't like it, even though, you know, when we talk about it, one of the really interesting, when we talk about it with kids, and we've read the book and discussed it with hundreds of kids, we've never had a kid, and we, you know, often say, well, what do you think was the message of the book? Virtually all kids, you know, first grade and up, get the message. The message is, you know, you should be fair to all people. Doesn't matter what their skin color is. Mm-hmm. Things should be fair. They should be treated fairly. Nobody says police officers are horrible.
Right.
Or police officers are bad guys.
Yeah, not at all.
Does, we do have discussions sometimes that police can make mistakes, just like everybody can make mistakes. You know, it can be scary and very dangerous if a police officer makes a mistake with his gun, obviously, because that can be deadly. But, you know, I don't have any problem standing up for that message.
I want to add to that. First of all, that the last thing that Anne said about other ways of talking about the police is in the back of the book. So we do address questions that kids might have about police there. But one of the most interesting conversations I had about something happened in our town was with police officers, educators, and some parents in a town outside of Binghamton, New York. Marietta, you were a part of that, right?
Yes, I was.
It was very interesting because they deliberately did a webinar that was open to parents in the community. And this is after highly publicized banning of our book in Binghamton. This is, I think, 2020. Or 2021, I can't remember. But what was fascinating is that once the two police officers that were part of the panel had read the book, they actually thought it was fine. You know, they didn't have any objection to the actual story. And one of the educators, who is very senior in the community, and is friends with, I guess, the police chief, said, you know, there are things that the police can do. Like you can stop passing on bad cops. You know, so we got some bad apples. You got to stop passing them on to the next town or to the next job. You know, there were some other suggestions that came out of that. And also on this call, we had SROs, I guess the police officer in the school, some of the schools have. And there was a young guy there who was the sort of police officer in the school. And he said that he had had, you know, very frank discussions with some of the students and had a whole different model of policing, you know, based on sort of community involvement and knowing the kids. And so it was a really productive discussion. And that was with several police members in the panel.
Oh, for sure. And what's interesting is that, you know, as we had met prior to the webinar, and at that time, the police officers had not read the book.
Right.
But once they read the book,
yeah, it was
funny. Then it was like, hey, there's nothing wrong with it. This is a pretty good book, you know.
But having said that, I did see the other question about the proper age for the book. And for all our books, the one on gun violence, this one, for all of them, we think it's the parents' decision to decide. You know, if their kid is old enough for this book. I mean, on the website, it'll say ages 4 to 8 or 5 to 9. But, you know, we have a population of children in mind, but we respect the views of the parent who knows their kid best, right? And knows when their kid is ready for this book.
Can you talk a little bit more about the pushback that you got for this particular book? And in what form does it come from the publishers, and they send you a short email, or how does that work? I've never published a book, so I'm really curious as to, I imagine you got quite a few rejections or no?
Because you
have established yourself in this series.
Nope. No, that's not how it happened. I know, it's really weird.
It is.
I'll tell you the story. So Imagination Press is, of course, an imprint of APA. We're all psychologists. We belong to APA. And sometime in 2016, someone from Imagination Press reached out to us through a friend and said, oh, we need some new books. we need some book titles, you know, how about something on trauma? And, you know, there's plenty of books on trauma. We didn't need to write another book about child trauma. And so we got together and came up with this idea and presented it to them. And they said, yes. And we were somewhat non-traditional in that we wanted all three of us, not just one author, but three of us. And we wanted to write our own note at the back of the book. Sometimes that's contracted out to somebody else. But we wanted to do it all ourselves. I mean, there's three of us. We can handle it. So, yeah. And then after that, the contracts for the other books were a little bit, you know, once we knew we were doing, that was a little easier to know what to expect. Yeah.
Thank you.
In terms of the book challenges, we don't have a clear overview of that. Probably you know, occasionally we'll get, you know, a principal will track us down and right. You know, usually the person that writes us is the person that's trying to stand up to the challenge and, right. You know, is asking us for help. Occasionally there might be an article in a local newspaper that someone sends us, but we don't, you know, we have no way to systematically know where it's being challenged or what the outcome is, unless there have been a couple of cases where we've gotten a little bit involved in trying, more directly involved in trying to help a community stand up. The American Library Association encourages people to let it, and they're tracking. That's how we ended up number six on their list of challenged books. So of the challenges that get reported to them, you know, they track, you know, what's being challenged. But even there's probably many more challenges happening that beyond what gets reported.
Yeah, what's typical is that we're open our emails and there's this letter, you know, there's some kind of a news article or a letter from someone who had been at a school board meeting and heard some dissension about our book. So that's typically what happens. I don't know if people have ever directly gone to Imagination Press. I think it comes to us, mm-hmm. You know, look at our email addresses, and they typically can find mine and Mary Ann's. They can't find Ann's as easily. and that's how things get going.
Wow. Well, I sure want to thank you all I just love discussions of books and everything about books. And this has been a really unusual program in terms of all of our other 100 plus programs. And I'm just so thankful that Jeremy was able to put this together with Rebecca and make something just so beautiful. Do you all know who Michael Threets is? The Reitz,
the TikTok librarian.
I know who he is. Trending. I know, big hair.
He's trending he's trending on TikTok, and he's on the spectrum. He admits that he's on the spectrum, but he's speaking all over the country about books, and I just love this. I love that's the topic that's trending on TikTok is Michael Threets, and I just love him. I love his attitude toward books and children, and I don't know. I just sort of envision you all partnering up with him or something, because you can't let this trend go away.
Especially right before Children's Book Week. I think Michael had a question. I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Michael. Go ahead. I didn't want to hog the whole program, which I normally do anyway. So I'm not going to apologize anymore.
No problem. And this somewhat goes to a piece of what I think Mary was asking. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mary Ann, but I thought you said that you didn't use the word racism in the first book.
We didn't use it at all in any book.
And can you talk about that decision? And was that something that the authors decided, or something that the publisher had some interest in? And what was your concern with using that word?
We decided, right? And I'll let
Marianne,
yeah, go ahead.
I think you should clarify that it's not in the book in the text for kids.
Right. That's what I meant.
It is in the book in the note to caretakers.
Right, right. Yeah. It's not in any story, right? It is in the back of two or three of them, right? Is it in the back of Dad, Anne? Do you talk about racism in the back of Dad? Yeah. So it's in the back, and yeah, in Planet, we talk about climate justice. So it's in our material for adults. But we chose not to do it for children for a number of reasons, one of which is the book is kind of aimed for 4 to 8 year olds. And racism is a very abstract concept that requires some knowledge of the world. You know, it requires kind of an adult sensibility, or at least a young adult or youth sensibility. And we wanted to talk about patterns, right? And it's, we talk about racism, we don't say racism, but we describe it as a pattern of being nice to white people and mean to Black people. You know, it's, and using words that young children would understand.
Right, yeah. Unfair pattern is what
unfair pattern.
Right, because it's very difficult to explain and to write a book, you know, for kids in that age group using those words, should I say.
The other problem is that you're limited as a children's book writer, you're limited, at least with Imagination Press, to 1,000 words. And so you don't want to introduce a concept and then define it, right? You know, that just takes up too many words and gets in the way of the flow of the story. And so they gave us 4,000 words for the note at the back of the book and 1,000 words for the story. So we had to be very careful about what words we included, right?
Okay, thank you.
I'd say another piece of that, and we had to struggle with this because we were coming, this was our first children's book. We're used to writing journal articles like many of y'all are. And, you know, we had to make sure not to be overly didactic because that will kill a story. So we had to really try to figure out, you know, how would families really talk about these concepts in conversations that felt more natural instead of more, you know, a teacher trying to, you know, teach a child this. And, you know, I think that, you know, parents or educators may use the word racism or racial injustice. Actually the subtitle is racial injustice.
Right.
Because justice and injustice can kind of go along with fairness and unfairness. Fair and unfair are the main words we use. Anyway, you know, I think the word racism may get used as the book is discussed, which is fine, but we just didn't use it in the story itself.
Right. The other thing we wanted to do, and this is really from a perspective of being intentional, is to show that, you know, I guess the importance of being able to be open and have dialogue across racial groups. You know, we had to be very open in discussions about, you know, from my perspective as the only Black author, you know, what I thought was being racially, I guess, incompetent or competent or sensitive or insensitive, or what was more reflective, you know, from the perspective of many Black families. Marianne and Anne, of course, you know, did the same in terms of the perspective of the white family. But we had to have an openness in terms of being able to trust, you know, trust our relationship as friends, and also, you know, the knowledge that we have as child psychologists. So.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being able to provide so much insight to the work that you all have done, the time that it took, the intent, the need for being very intentful with our language. This has been amazing, and I'm sure that everyone here has wanted to show you some deep appreciation for your work, so and the series of work that you've been completing. So thank you all for being here today, for joining us. Thank you for the Q&A, and I hope you all have a blessed rest of your weekend.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.